Hello everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Success in Finance. Joining me today is David Bloom. So David currently is an interim FD with a few board roles as well, got his fingers in a few different pies. So he's going to talk us through his career to date, with key themes being around surrounding yourself with good people and having that growth mindset. So he started out in audit at a regional firm before going into corporate finance at KPMG for a couple of years. From there, he went into an FD role based in New Zealand and then spent 5 years at Getty Images, joining them early on and seeing them grow over that time. He then tried to set up his own venture, Flaming Nora, a posh kebab shop in the UK back in London, which had some success but ultimately didn't quite work out. And since then he's undertaken a number of different FD and CFO roles, and as I say is now on the board of a few different companies. I hope you enjoy the episode, and don't forget, subscribe, share and comment. You can also check out the confirmed future guests at successinfinance.co.uk, and you can watch some recent interviews on my YouTube channel as well. Thanks. Hi, David. Thanks for joining me on Success in Finance this week. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Danny. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Great to have you, and looking forward to hearing about your career. Do you just want to start us off then with a quick summary of what you've done so far, and then we'll dive in a bit deeper?
Sure. I qualified way, way, way back in 1994, feels like about 300 years ago. I trained with a small firm called Jeffreys Henry. I left practice pretty much the day I qualified. I knew I didn't want to stay as an accountant, and went into KPMG Corporate Finance. I spent a couple of years there. I was very interested to understand how businesses got bought, got sold, funds got raised, etc. And I thought that was something I wanted to do for a long time. But actually, while I was there, I sat in quite a few completion meetings and saw these guys and girls sort of making good money out of businesses they'd built, and realized that's the path I wanted to take, sort of being in industry as opposed to in corporate finance. And I'm sure we'll dive into a bit more detail, but I've spent the best part of 25 years in all different kinds of businesses, different situations, worked overseas. Culminating in where I am today, which is a portfolio finance director with currently one main client and about half a dozen other clients that I provide sort of FD services to. That's a whistle-stop swashbuckling tour through 25 years there.
Yeah, well, like you say, hopefully we'll get a bit more detail on those as we go through. So thanks for that summary. So I guess the first thing then, you said you started at a smaller practice, Jeffreys Henry. What were the benefits of a smaller practice, do you think, in hindsight?
I think the benefits for me are the variety of work. And I don't know whether this holds true today, but I remember back then talking to an old cousin who went into KPMG, and the advice he gave me was you got to be careful you don't get stuck on a particular area of the P&L or balance sheet, and as you sort of climb through the ranks. Whereas in a smaller firm, you do sort of more variety, what they called brown paper bag jobs, which probably don't happen anymore with Xero and QuickBooks, but you literally get all the invoices and receipts and checkbooks, and you'd have to cobble together a set of accounts. And I just probably got to see a lot more, but I never did the big six at the time, so I couldn't say that for sure. But I certainly got a good broad overview as to the language of business, you know, numbers and how accounts got made up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that point that your friend made, or your cousin, about the getting stuck on one area. I remember when I started out at BDO, I had mates at KPMG, and they were saying they would just audit cash for months on end. So I think that does sort of still hold true today, although that was probably about 7 years ago now, so it may have changed. Yeah. But so what, after you qualified, did you always know that the audit was just the foundation, or did you just hear about this role with KPMG and dive into it that way?
I've always been entrepreneurial. I mean, back at university, I had a small business which was, would you believe, selling squares around an A3 piece of paper that had a calendar on it for all the events that were going on at uni on sort of a rolling monthly basis. So there was something entrepreneurial in me, and I kind of knew I had to get a professional qualification just in case things sort of went wrong, which although I've had a fair amount of success, I've also had a fair bit of failure, and it was always something to fall back on. So yes, I did it for the qualification, and then I thought corporate finance to me was the sexy end of what accountants did. As I said, sort of looking at helping business plans, doing information memorandums, etc. So I literally proactively sought out a role in corporate finance, I think within days of qualifying.
Yeah. Okay. And was it the M&A side you were on, or more the transaction services and the due diligence pieces?
Well, back then it was called corporate finance. It was M&A. I was based in the Reading office, so I
Right.
was driving from London out to Reading, and there was a small team there, and that's where the role came up. There was a growing team because of all the technology in Silicon Glen, as they called it, and all the surrounds in Reading, etc. So we were doing transaction services. We were putting together. It was more doing the information memorandums. It was networking, trying to bring in the deals,
Right.
and it was sort of all round. It wasn't totally split up the way it is today, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, no, it sounds like a bit more of a mixture, which I guess is a good thing anyway.
Yes.
So whilst you were there then, what were the foundations from audit that helped you, and what was the sort of new stuff that you learned that have then gone on to assist you as you've moved on in your career?
Well, I think with audit and the qualification generally, it just you get to understand numbers and businesses. And as I say and always do, numbers are the language of business. And you can get a sense of what the business have done. But then when you get into the world of forecasting and putting together a memorandum to try and dress the business up for sale. I mean, obviously, you've got to be as objective as you can be, but that was just a whole new world in terms of how best to position a business. And, a business is worth what someone's prepared to pay for it. You can do a valuation, but as you get stuck into a transaction and you go to market and due diligence and putting the data room together, et cetera, an expression I sort of use a lot is, beginning with the end in mind. Every situation I go into now, I'm always thinking about that data room and trying to get everything as perfect as possible ready for sale. Because during my time there and subsequently, if you haven't crossed the T's and dot the I's, simple things like have you got all employment contracts signed or the insurance documents in place? That contract looks like it's ending with that customer in 3 months' time. There's so much preparation that needs to be done. And those are things that, again, when I did the qualification, it may not be the case now, but you don't, you can get a qualification in corporate finance and learn a lot of this stuff, but
Yeah.
it's only best done on the job. And every situation is different.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there any projects that spring to mind that you particularly learnt a lot on, or were just interesting, that you can remember?
They were all interesting, to be honest with you, because I've done the qualification, I've done plenty of auditing, etc. But I remember a business called AdWest, which was a public company. It's no longer on the market, I believe, and they were disposing of four non-core engineering businesses. So we put all the documentation together for that. There was a valuation exercise for a couple of race courses, would you believe it, out there. That was sort of interesting, and
Yeah, interesting.
putting that together, and then also in help with some fundraising, helping to put sort of a business plan together and some basic financial models, which if I think sort of back then I was allowed to pull that together for KPMG compared to what I do today. I think I was quite privileged, and I think they were quite mad, to be honest. But again, it was just a real eye-opener, and just that the whole process of selling a business, which is there's quite a lot of art to it as well. and just watching my bosses and peers at the time, how they went about it. It was an amazing learning curve. But as I say, it was not, I also knew, having had a few reviews there and I had some conversations like, you know, David, you've had a good year. If you carry on, you might get from, I think they called it a D1 to a D2 back then.
Right.
And part of my makeup is I just don't like waking up knowing what tomorrow's going to bring. Mm. And I just couldn't see myself staying within, you know, a big four practice. It just wasn't for me.
Yeah, and I know what you mean, because it's one of the pros of being in practice, but also one of the cons is that, you know, if you keep doing this work, that in a year you'll get promoted to this. But then you also know that no matter how well you perform in a year, you'll get to that level, and you can't like sort of jump and do anything. So I guess you were more the restless type that wasn't happy with that structured progression.
I think that's exactly right. I think there's pluses and minuses to it. I mean, if you want to talk about it in pure sort of financial terms, if you're good and you stay in practice, you can have a very, very good, very, very lucrative career if you ride that wave all the way through. If you're more like me, the restless type, as you say, and you're more entrepreneurial, you'll kind of take your chances. And whereas practice might be sort of a straight line curve, bottom left up to top right, mine's going to be that sort of wavy line that sort of goes up and down and a little bit all over the place. And, you know, you're obviously trying to do it in the hope that you make a big financial gain along the way. But it's also the cut and thrust of, you know, a new area, new market, new sector, helping a business grow. I'm never going to help KPMG grow. I'm just going to be a bit part in a much, much bigger engine. And, you know, it's horses for courses. There's no right or wrong way.
Yeah, definitely. And I like that description of the graph, actually. That's good imagery. But yeah, so you said, was it a gradual thing that you were sitting in these meetings and presumably seeing the earnouts from all the share options and things and thinking, wow, if I do a good job in industry, I can make a lot of money? Or was it like it just happened in one meeting and then you're like, I need to move?
There was one meeting with a business that sold a very successful hardware business to, I think they were called Seagate at the time, which was a big, would you believe, disk drive manufacturer in the States. And just understanding the journey that the two guys had been on, building it from nothing into something that sold, I think at the time, for 40 million plus. And it was grueling. And, you know, you hear these stories about along that way, it went bust a couple of times, but they had a bit of luck here, a bit of luck there. It was just something I wanted to be a part of, part of a story, really, to be honest. And that's where I sort of, every time I sat in a few of them, but I was always coming at the end and I wanted to be part of the journey.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So what appealed about Getty Images then? And I know that was in Seattle at a point. Was it Seattle from the start?
No. So Getty Images, my brother, who knows one of the owner's nephews, or there was some relation there, he said, you have to go and talk to this guy, Jonathan Klein, because he's got together with Mark Getty of the Getty family, and they're going to take the stock photography industry world by storm. And they'd bought a couple of businesses. And I was actually a public company FD, would you believe? Keystone Software was one of the early AIM companies. And I was quite enjoying that. They had an operation in New Zealand where I spent a bit of time. I wasn't so mad on the investor relations side, but my brother, who's normally been right, actually, in my career, said, look, you have to go and have a chat with them. So I did. Long story short, I ended up commuting about an hour and a half every day down to Colliers Wood for a business they'd acquired called Allsport. And Allsport was their first editorial photography acquisition. These were the guys that you see with the big long lenses by in the dugouts at the Premiership matches and right. Formula One. And I remember showing up in a suit and having the Mickey taken out of me, because these guys were all kind of, you know, photographers and, you know, ladettes basically. But yeah, my job was the suit to try and bring them into the fold of Getty and put in all the corporate reporting, which I did. And they were so acquisitive over the first sort of year and a half. I found myself becoming the CFO of the editorial division, which is about a $60 million business. So all their editorial assets that were outside of the core creative pictures fell under my boss's remit. I sort of rode his coattails. Fantastic experience. But then about halfway through that journey, they decided to consolidate all of their acquisitions onto one common platform, do away with the editorial being a different business to the creative. And the new CFO, a lady called Liz Hebner, best ever boss I ever had, she kind of came over, got on really well with her. And she said, David, you've got a choice. Look, we either don't need you in this role or come to Seattle and help me integrate all working at BHS, but I managed to persuade her that, you know, Seattle was the place to go. So I ended up in Seattle, and I would say it was the crowning moment of my career, where I led a team of 50 plus people, multi-territory, with the help of Capgemini, and we integrated all of their acquisitions onto Oracle Financials. And there were so many legacy entities and systems that we had to collapse. It was just a brilliant experience. And I learned many things during that process, one of which is definitely don't like the public company arena. I much prefer to be in the weeds, fixing stuff and sort of putting processes and procedures, you know, the old operational hands-on FD approach, which I think is moved through and through.
Yeah, and within that integration, am I right in saying that you won the Accountancy Age Accountant of the Year award as well?
Yeah, we did. That's not something I talk about too much at parties, I must tell you, because I find people leave the room, as you can imagine. But the team put a submission in, and basically I wanted it to be sort of a team effort, but Accountancy Age, they only had it for the individual. So although I got the award, I always say there was a massive team behind that. But yeah, it's one of the proudest periods of my career, to be honest with you. It's the old one about, I mean, a lot of situations I see, companies, they don't fix the plumbing. They're more interested in painting the walls and making the house look pretty without getting the basic processes in place. And that was fundamental to getting that, that integration done. For example, they had over 7,000 different photographer contract variations, and they were trying to solve that technically by getting those different combinations into a system, because they had a bleeding edge technology function there. But I along with the CFO, the CEO and others sort of suggested, well, hold on, why don't we just try and come up with one commercial photographer arrangement wherever possible, and then worry about the technology afterwards? And it was really grueling lobbying and sessions and meetings to get that in place before they went ahead and did the technology. The challenge was some of that technology had started. So I didn't make myself popular in some quarters, but another lesson along the way is you have to have sponsorship. If you've got the right sponsorship in the right places, you can move mountains. If you don't, and you're just sort of banging your own drum, forget it and move on.
Okay, that's an interesting point, actually, yeah. So thanks for that. Just out of interest, at what point were Getty quite early in their sort of growth then when you joined?
Yeah, I mean, they'd acquired a couple of leading edge stock photography businesses. So back in the day, you're going back 15 plus years or whatever, or 20 years even. If you wanted to put a photograph, use a photograph for your magazine or whatever, you would go to a stock site as opposed to paying a lot of money for a photographer to do it. That was the business model. And they bought the businesses that were best at that. But then, you know, funds from Getty, et cetera, they put a technology department together, and they openly stated two things. This is all going to become digital, and we're going to tell the photographers the sort of pictures we want you to take. So what would happen is photographers would take photos, the best ones would go into brochures, and then advertising agencies would look through the brochures and hopefully find something that was right for their campaign. But Getty turned around and said, actually, photographers, we're going to ask the creative agencies what they want, and then we want you to go and take the two photos. And I just felt at that time that combination of vision
what they wanted to acquire and capital. I knew it would be a rocky ride, and it was, but it proved to be very successful.
Yeah, and what were the key things that you think were really good about being in such a fast-paced, dynamic environment? And what did you enjoy about being in Seattle as well?
Well, I loved being in Seattle. Personally, it was just a great place to be. There was so much you could see and do, and it was just a very, a different experience. I also learned how to speak American English, which is slightly different, and how to deal with sort of Americans, which is I love their approach to work. I mean, it takes a certain skill, I think, to work with Americans, which I can sort of go into a bit more detail if you want. But
yeah, please do.
It was also the head office. It's where everything was. All the top table were there, and even if you're in a fast growth market and you've got super bright people working with you and you're well funded, it is still a huge challenge. But what happens is if you can read the tea leaves correctly, is it's fluid, opportunities open up. And there was an expression at the time that went round, which was Getty is a great business despite itself. And what they meant by that was there's lots of egos there. We'd acquired all these companies. We kept all the CEOs or owners of those businesses on, and they thought they knew the answer to everything. So you're managing all of those egos. As soon as you got one integration done, there was another one or two on the way. It was madness, to be honest with you. But there was just something almost mythological about it, about they were trying to take over the world. The culture they created was superb. I think now, the tender age of 50, 52, I might have seen it differently. But back then, late 20s, early 30s, it was the best thing ever for, an ambitious finance professional.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you want to go into a bit more detail then about dealing with Americans?
So the best example, I mean, I've got a couple of friends to this day who, they're super bright, far cleverer than I am. But if you've got a slight attitude around, well, they're American, they don't understand English accounting, leave that to me and I'll take care of it. Whilst they may be right, sometimes you have to win them over. You can't stop winning them over. And even then, sometimes I've seen it where they'll want to take the glory for the work they've done because they've conquered the world. And you've got to be egoless about it. You've got to just, keep your eye on the prize because the rewards will come. But they're very aggressive. They work very, very hard. 10 working days, holiday a year for most of them over there. You can be fired at will. It's just a different culture to working in a British business. I think the playing field's leveled off a bit, to be honest with you. You have to be very competitive in this day and age. But I just love the buzz and energy, the can-do anything attitude. I mean, it was, some horrific mistakes get made, and some people would argue that's not good. But I always say never let an accountant run a business. Let them be a good number two.
Yeah. Okay. So you're not a fan of CFOs moving to CEO then?
I am. If they've got the right attitude. It's just you absolutely can, but don't bring the scorekeeping, number crunching, or you can't do that mentality. Sometimes you have to, you analyze your risk, obviously, but sometimes you have to take bets and you have to move quickly. And if you sit there and you do the old analysis paralysis, you can end up with an opportunity sort of, moving away. For example, do you go do a land grab, buy six or seven businesses that make up 60% of the market, and then sort out, the internal crap afterwards? Or do you do it one by one and get everything perfect? There's a balance. Yeah. And somewhere between those two extremes is the right approach.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So, after your 5 years at Getty, then you decided to move on. Why was that?
I was really happy at Getty. I was nudging sort of the top table there. I didn't really want to come home, but long story short, my wife did, wanted to start a family back in the UK. I was getting a little bit tired of sitting behind the screen all day long, looking at numbers, spreadsheets, etc. And I had sort of the entrepreneurial bug nudging away at the back of my mind. So believe it or not, we came back to the UK and I thought the world needed posh kebabs. So I came up with this business idea called Flaming Nora. Long story short, you know, a few pints in the pub, love a good kebab on the way home, like a lot of my fellow Brits, I'm sure, but could never get Mrs. B into one of them. But then equally, grilled meat on a bed of salad, very healthy option if you're looking to lose weight, etc. So I came up with this very female-friendly brand called Flaming Nora. And I'd had a good outcome at Getty. I was fortunate to be in a financial position where I could sort of fulfill my dream of doing something. So with some of my own cash, which was important because I went and raised another million, up to about a million off, anyone who would listen to me and buy into my vision. And we got the first store open in Islington, North London. It did really well. Managed to raise a bit more money to open a second one in Wood Green, which did terribly. And I did have a VCT, Venture Capital Trust deal on the table to roll out another three if I could demonstrate that the second one would come good and be better than the first. It didn't. Maybe I gave up a bit too quickly, but I can be pretty dispassionate about even my own business if I can see that it's not going to work. So that was my sort of entrepreneurial flair, probably not the wrong words, didn't work out. I realized during that process, you know, I can raise money and I was, you know, good at reporting to shareholders. I was good at, I believe, spending money in the right place, branding and what have you. But I don't feel now I'm sort of that number one CEO entrepreneur type. I'm best supporting them, which I guess I only found out going through the process. But I've got no regrets, to be honest with you.
No, maybe it's an amazing thing to have done. With the question that springs to my mind, why did you go for Wood Green?
If you know the area, I had about 20 staff in Islington and a lot of Eastern Europeans, and their mates were coming in and they were eating there and they were enjoying it. And they suggested that as an area. So I didn't just sort of listen to them. I went to Wood. I just looked. I had an agent that was looking everywhere. And a subway unit came up opposite the KO nightclub. And, you know, what better location? And I did my foot traffic counts. I was out there probably the best part of a couple of weeks, literally, you know, dressed up in warm clothes, counting people coming in and out. And it all looked fine and good. And because all their mates sort of lived in and around that area, I just figured it would be great. And it got off to a massive start in the first week or two. But then literally after everyone tried it, it dropped off. And I think it was a function of probably a bit too posh for the area. People would end up going sort of down the road to the, you know, back to where they were. But having said that, Danny, again, another learning, capital intensive business. I begged, stealed and borrowed to get that open. And, you know, you're talking 150 grand plus just to get a unit up and running, and cash was running short. So we just didn't give it enough time, really. And I didn't want to dilute myself down to, you know, something so low that I was better off getting a job.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But no, it sounds like a great experience. And in terms of the fundraising, how did you find that and how did you sort of go about it?
I put a business plan together. I did a lot of research. I started by talking to some high net worth experienced people that I knew. And I didn't go to them saying, I want to raise money from you. It was, can you give me some advice and guidance on my business plan before I go to market, so to speak? What do you think? And that was a very, very useful approach. You never ask them for money at that point. You get some very, very helpful feedback. So, for example, having done quite a bit of reading, my business plan had the restaurant concept, but also it was a property play. The idea was if we could find locations where I was the tenant, if the business could afford to pay a higher rent and we had the building, the value of the building would go up. And I was sort of adopting the McDonald's model in my business plan. But the advice I got was, yeah, that can come later, but don't make it too complicated. Stick to the basics. Don't try and be too clever. And one thing led to another. I literally, you know, from just what experience I had around selling, etc. You always ask people for referrals. Is there anyone you know? And I literally must have had 150 plus meetings, etc. But even my old boss at KPMG invested in it, and you know, we still talk to this day. So he's I did everything by the book. So that was grueling, and I realized I couldn't do everything. So I had with me a senior manager from Yum Brands. He was he'd rolled out a bunch of Pizza Hut franchises, and he was the guy that was helping get everything set up. Fundraising's a full-time job.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be. Okay, so at the point then that you decided to sort of call it a day with Flaming Nora, what did you do next? Was it a case of just get any job, or did you have a bit of time to think about what you wanted to do and then secure the right role?
I had a contracting role, which isn't on my CV, for a few months while I was looking for something else. But I realized I kind of wanted to go and get back to being a CFO in a fast growth business. I had a success at Getty, and I was just looking for something where I could leverage all that skill and sort of repeat the process. And that is what I did at Glue Mobile.
Yes. So do you want to talk me through a bit about what they did and your time there as well?
So Glue Mobile, it is still to this day, it's on NASDAQ. It's changed quite a lot now, but it's a game business. When I was there, they made games for all the different handsets. So whether that was Nokia, Motorola, Vodafone was just coming through. It would be everything from really simple stuff, like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So they'd have the franchise for the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire mobile game, through to some more complicated first person shoot 'em ups on your phone. And back then, every single handset had to have its own different version of the game. They'd acquired Glue, a small UK business run by a chap called Christian Sagerstrahler, who was, and still to this day, is like one of the leading lights within the mobile gaming space. And the view was that acquisition was going to be their beachhead for a European expansion. I'd replaced an FD who had similar traits to what I was saying earlier. Very, very bright guy, got on very, very well with the individual, but I think just didn't see eye to eye with how the Americans wanted things to run. And I think the analogy was, he wanted to run it this way, they wanted to run it that way. Therefore, you have to run it that way, whether they like it or not. And you're either comfortable with that conflict or you're not. And can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Sorry. So we set about rolling out our operations into six European territories. I was actually dead against it. What we had was bilingual French, German, Italian speakers in the London office. They were flying over to deal with, the Telefonicas in Spain, the Bouygues in Belgium, etc., coming back to the UK. And I knew from my Getty days, once you sort of open offices in European territories, you've got this thing called permanent establishment, which I try not to talk about too much because people's eyes glaze over, but all sorts of
tax stuff, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
It rings a vague bell.
All of the stuff that comes with it, dealing with local accountants and what have you. Anyway, we went ahead and did that. We bought a studio in Moscow as well. And, great experience. And that company floated on NASDAQ while I was there. And I thought, here we go again. There's going to be another great ride. But long story short, the business completely missed the iPhone, completely missed it, an iPad, and the whole move towards free games coming online. So the business is still going. Credit to the guys there, and the CFO there, who's now a very, very good friend of mine, who's stuck with it and done incredibly well out of it. They've ended up doing sort of all different games. So, for example, I think one of the Kardashians put her brand name against one of their engines, which was like a shopping game, and that just sort of sent in-app purchases through the roof and what have you. But again, very, very good experience, and I enjoyed my time there, actually.
Good. And how involved were you in that listing on NASDAQ?
I was very involved in terms of prepping and getting all the documentation together. I was not frontline dealing with the advisors that took it public, but certainly long, long hours putting information together, redoing information, getting it into, you know, US GAAP compliance. There were some pretty grueling nights in that process. So I was, I would like to think I was a fairly important cog in the wheel. At the time, from memory, I think it probably represented about 30, 40% of the business.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that sounds like a hard work and not necessarily the exciting stuff either.
Yeah, and I don't think now I would do it again. I think that's an age thing, though. I, you know, dealing with the West Coast, they get up at 4 p.m. your time in the UK is when they start work. So you are, if you're in one of those fast growth environments, you can expect to work incredibly long hours, you know, in their daytime when there's acquisitions or transactions in place. And I think at the time I did it, I enjoyed it. I've got no regrets, but, you know, maybe after, you know, 25, 30 plus years, I think there's easier ways to make money now.
Yeah.
For me personally.
Definitely. So yeah, you moved on. Why was that again? Just the time had come for something different.
Well, no, I mean, being honest, they saw what the iPhone iPad was doing. We built up this big operation in Europe. Christian, the CEO, had moved on, and they then downsized it, and I had to downsize a big chunk of the operation. And I knew during that process I was going to be one of those at the end. So I was made redundant. Only time that's ever happened in my career, actually.
Fair play. Yeah, so then you moved on. Was it to Kultura Creative Net?
So while I was at Glue, an old buddy of mine from Getty, basically we were a double act. After I did the integration, there was a lot of work needed with the photographers in terms of reporting to them and giving them the correct information online so that they could download it and see how their royalties were faring. And this chap was the head of photographer relations. He kind of dealt with the individuals and the issues and the communication. And I would sort of work side by side with him in the back office, preparing everything and delivering on the promises, or most of the promises that he made. He came knocking on my door when I was at Blue, saying, look, I've now left Getty, but I'm going to set up a business that represents some of the photographers, basically selling pictures to Getty and about 100 plus other agents around the world. So I was working, believe it or not, nights and weekends with him, getting a similar sort of thing, getting the back office accounting and royalty engine set up for his little business. So that was going on while I was at Glue. It wasn't my main gig. Okay. When I left Glue, again, my brother came into play again, because he told me that his best buddy started thinking about, you know, setting up his own recruitment operation. And I came to realize at that time a couple of things. The value a good FD, an operational FD, can bring to an SME. I really feel that in certain situations, it's a make or break role. You know, things like managing cash flow, fundraising, et cetera, but being on the inside. And then also realizing that putting all your eggs in one basket. So, you know, Getty, I had a great outcome. It was what I was doing 100% of the time. Flaming Nora, all my eggs in one basket, that didn't work out for me. Yeah. Glue was, I thought, here we go again, it's going to be great. It kind of, as fast as it rocketed, it sank. So I was formulating this idea of a practice whereby you could put FDs in portfolio FDs into different situations and try and take a small piece of the equity in those businesses. Yeah. And I just got talking to my brother's best mate, and one thing led to another, and we formed what's now the FDU Group, which has been going for 10 plus years. And that is a business that, you know, places part-time FDs into companies. But the main thing was for me to find gigs, which I've been doing pretty much for the last 10 years. I'm not that involved day to day within the recruitment side. I'm just sort of a non-exec for that business.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. So what sort of stuff do you do as the non-exec there then?
So, well, for the recruitment business?
Yeah, yeah. For
the same I do for all the other situations. I work with a CEO who's got a plan and a vision, and there I put in a controller or a finance team, and I shape the management information and help the team deliver that information in a way that gives full visibility to the leadership team. The analogy I always use is you're going down a windy road in the car. Do you want your lights on half beam or full beam? And I'm just always thinking about how you get the lights on full beam so you can sort of see the road ahead. In my position, being a number two, not necessarily a number one, I'm always going to be reliant to a large extent on the CEO's vision, the market they're in, etc. And I just try and do everything I can to help them achieve their goals. Plus, with FDU, because I've built up a pretty good network over the years, and people come to me, it's like, you know, David, can you help me? I sort of go, well, no, not at the minute, but I know someone who might be able to find someone for you. That's been quite useful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And we'll come back to your other board roles in a second. But just before we do that, so you've had, I guess as part of that idea that you came up with, you've been doing a bit of interim FD stuff. So you've spent some time at Fizzback, Ping Pong, and Silver Hub Media. How did you find those roles?
How did I sort of source them and get them, or?
How did you find working as sort of an interim FD?
I really enjoy it. I think it plays to my strengths. And I would say, although every situation is different, I'm learning to put in sort of almost a formulaic approach to how to go about it. And, you know, to share a little bit of insight, it's something I'm thinking about now in terms of, you know, whether there's even a course I could put together to help people that really want to aspire to be SME FDs. So you go into these situations, you need to be sponsored. So typically a VC, private equity, they put some cash in. Everyone's acknowledged that the finance function needs work. And the first thing I typically put together is a cash flow. I think it's the most important document of all. Some of the situations I get involved in, they don't have a proper cash flow. It might be a week, it might be a month. It's not sort of a rolling 6 to 12 month. So you go and you put the cash flow. It's a very good way of understanding what's going on very quickly. And suddenly, you know, you're asking questions about how does this work? How does that work? What's the order to cash workflow? So how do you go from a sales order through to cash coming in? What's the procure to pay workflow? Each situation, you know, Fizzback they've grown pretty quickly. They didn't have a proper cash flow tool. They wanted to know what the burn was, and off the back of the burn, begin to get some quality MI out. Ping Pong, that was a case of they needed to replace the CFO with a new CFO. They wanted someone to come in and just sort of hold the fort for a while, which is what I did. And, you know, during that process, that was the classic retail situation where they got a portfolio of 15 sites and 80% of the money is coming from 20% of the locations. And it was just sort of presenting information in a way that maybe that particular site you might want to think about shutting down because the premium you might get on that lease in the center of London could help pay off sort of 20% of your debt. I just enjoy being thrown in at the deep end. I think I've learned enough through loads of mistakes that I've got the confidence that although I still learn every day, I think I know what's required to keep businesses going, really. Don't get me wrong, you're talking SME here. I mean, I would be the last person in the world you'd want to put into a utility or an airline. But, you know, a sub 30 million turnover services business, I know my way around those pretty well now.
Yeah, I can imagine. Just before we get back onto the board roles then, there's a couple of CFO roles we haven't touched upon yet, Outdoor Plus and Uni LED Solutions. Was there anything specific that you wanted to draw out from your time there?
Outdoor Plus was brilliant. That was, despite me telling about the portfolio role, that was pretty much a 4 day a week, on some cases 7 day a week role. A private equity house, a very good one called Inflection, had just bought into the business. This is a business that did those big out-of-home large format screens you see along the side of the roads. And they'd won a tender with Transport for London to put up another dozen of these sites, which if you're traveling on any arterial road outside of London, you will see they now have Global written on the side of them because Global came in and bought the business. But they were the big screens. Mm-hmm. And that was a phenomenal experience, you know, working with a very, very successful private equity house and the demands that they require on reporting, etc. But also it was highly geared. And there was lots of covenant tests that were needed with the bank every quarter. And that was all about not waiting until the end of the quarter to report. You needed. And the business did not grow as quickly as the thesis suggested. And off the back of that, there were some fairly sort of hairy moments. And I just learned an awful lot about I guess being the honest broker and how to manage relationships between the chairman, the CEO, the banks, and the investors. You never stop learning. Every situation is different because it's different sort of personalities. But that was a very, very good experience. And 2 years ago, the business sold to Global. They bought us, and unbeknown to us, they bought two other businesses in the space. Good experience, though.
Yeah, and just going back to the covenants, did you, from the sound of it, you missed a few of the covenant requirements? Is that
we did? No, we it was hairy. We could see we were going to, but I think again, a good part of a good CFO will be aware of that, and will do everything in their power to work with the team to try and solve for it. And now the business was doing okay. It was doing pretty well, to be honest with you. It just wasn't quite as quick, but we got through by the skin of our teeth on a couple of occasions. And, you know, had we not have been bought, you know, maybe a couple of quarters on, there was a high probability we would have breached. I think we got out in the nick of time, to be honest with you. But hey, we could have refinanced at that point. Maybe something else would have happened. I think one of the skills I've picked up is building a financial model that isn't so complicated that you're the only one that can understand it. I think that's a critical part of what I do. It's you have the engine that works in terms of putting the numbers in and the forecasting, but the outputs are there so that whether you're an equity investor, whether you're a bank and you want to see what the forecast covenant tests look like, it's kind of this all singing, all dancing tool. And I would say a lot of what I do is grounded in the financial model that I put into my clients, along with the cash flow.
Yeah. And I guess you sort of mentioned it before about being on top of the numbers and the foresight to maybe communicate in advance with the banks about the situation.
Yes. I think again, I've picked up these... Actually, my nickname with a lot of my clients, they laugh about it, but it's gloomy bloomy. But they always say it in jest. It's because I see myself as the canary in the coal mine. Trust me, I'm absolutely not the CFO that says no, 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 you can't do that. No, no. It's all about, okay, let's have a look at this and let's have a look at the ROI on it. If you want to go and do this, here's the risks associated with it. And I won't work in any situation. In fact, I'll leave a situation if I think it's being run by numpties. But yeah. I like to work with ambitious CEOs that are going places. But it is all about operating in a no surprises environment.
Yeah.
I'll take bad news any day. I'll deal with it. I cannot stand surprises. That's my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Okay, so just before we wrap up then, do you want to run through in a bit more detail the board roles? So are they all ongoing at the moment? So there's the growth project, PromoterGo, Fractal Labs, and obviously FDU, which we mentioned already.
Yeah, so they are all ongoing. There's a couple of others there. And I'm not with some of them, I am, you can go to company's house and you'll see my name as a director, but they're sort of non-exec advisory. And really with Unilead, where I am now. So Unilead, I got into because off the back of Outdoor Plus, Unilead are the guys that look after the screens. They not only sort of maintain the physical structures, but they also deliver the adverts to those screens on behalf of the media owners and the agencies. And there I've got what I call, you know, my full service. That is, I'm attending weekly leadership team meetings. We've put the financial controller in there. I'm working with the FD, a great guy called Tom, and we've really put in a proper finance function that's fit for scale. And that there's a lot of growth there, which is excited about. Pairing back from that, these non-exec roles are really just attending, you know, monthly meetings, being available on hand to talk to the CEOs, putting in cash flows, working with the incumbent controllers, managers, just generally giving sort of leadership and direction as and when needed. Now, that will involve also building financial models for them when they're fundraising. I help out with the fundraising process. And they are they're exciting. And it's stuff that I sort of squeeze in as and when, and they're comfortable with that.
Great. No, it sounds interesting to have that variety and different things going on at different times. So do you enjoy that element of it?
I do. My wife doesn't so much. I will admit, I'm a workaholic. I always have been. I probably always will be. I can't sit still. You know, leading into, you know, things I would guidance on. I mean, I couldn't articulate this a few years ago, but I would say, having read about it, I've got what's called a growth mindset. I love, I'm hyper inquisitive. I like to learn. I love talking to techies or, you know, whatever the roles in the business, just the way I am. I mean, I've learned not to bore people stupid at dinner parties. That's, you know, keep it quite short and clear. But I love the variety. To be honest, I just want to be involved in fast growth situations. I want to work with people that are trying to achieve their goals as best as I can.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned that growth mindset. Do you just want to talk a bit more in your words about that? Because I've definitely come across it in a few books that I've read recently. But it'd be good to hear what your interpretation of it is.
To me, a growth mindset is just being open to learning, and don't think because, you know, you're 52, which I am, that I've had all this experience, therefore I must know more than someone who's 25 or 30. Everyone's got their life experiences, and, you know, it's about surrounding yourself with people that are, you know, brighter than you. They've come from different backgrounds, and just to learn. I think a lot of people have a closed mindset, which is, you know, I've had 30 years of experience. I therefore must know more than anyone who hasn't been around as much as me. But as I say to people, you know, if you've done books the same way for 20 years, if you've done them incorrectly, you've got 20 years of incorrect experience. Yeah. You know, there's just my inbox is filled with too much stuff, to be honest with you, but just keeping a pace with all the different accounting systems and what Xero does, what QuickBooks do, always trying to look for efficiencies. You never know. And again, just through networking, you never know who you're going to meet. It's just being open to learning and just saying to yourself, you know, you're a student forever. LinkedIn, yeah. For example, I don't know how many people have explored LinkedIn Learning, but there's some fabulous, you know, free digestible videos on there just to learn how to, you know, basic PowerPoint, how to put presentations together, you know, learn another half a dozen formulas in Excel that you might never have used, etc.
Yeah, no, I've seen that LinkedIn Learning. I think I looked at one of the videos on there, but yeah, I've not seen too much more of it. Is it quite easy to access?
Very, yeah. No, well, I'm on LinkedIn Premium, and I think I'm only paying like 20 quid a month, so maybe it's on that. But no, I think LinkedIn Learning, there is a lot of free stuff. But if not, there's websites like Udemy, Udemy. There's plenty of learning sources out there. I try and learn one fact or something every day if I can. No, you know, just in the back of my mind, it's always there. Problem at my age is your memory starts going. That's why my dad says that.
No, it's a good approach, isn't it? I like that. So, in terms of advice that you'd give to aspiring finance professionals, then, what would you suggest?
I think definitely learn the technical stuff. In this day and age, it's a given that you understand numbers and you understand, you know, the P&L, the balance sheet, the cash flow, how it all operates. And I can only talk in terms of my experience, which is going down the commercial finance route. So I am not interested in financial accounting. And what I mean by that is, you know, making sure that the stats at the end of the year are perfect and comply with all the latest IFRS's and regulations. I leave that to my accountant to do in the situations I'm in. That bores me crazy. So horses for courses, that might be the route that some people want to go down. In my world, you've still got to understand the basics and, you know, how the numbers sort of work. I would try and get blue chip experience on your CV. I'm glad I went to KPMG. Could I have spent another couple of years in business in a much larger corporate? That might have been a good thing to do. I sort of all the commercial roles I've had have been in these fast growth or supposed fast growth situations. I've had to learn on the job. But I sometimes wonder, had I been a controller for another couple of years in a blue chip brand, I might still end up in the same place. And I think, you know, you do learn when things aren't going well. Because you have to, you've got to sort of work out what to do. Pick an area you like. I genuinely really enjoy what I do. I realize I like helping people. Numbers are my thing, and the finance, etc. I enjoy it. So I think that's important. And get yourself into fast growth situations at the right time, because they're fluid. Things move very quickly. I was a public company FD at about 27 Keystone. And then I was lucky. This is all luck rather, you know, when I got to Getty, I rode the coattails of my boss there, who was, and he had three acquisitions thrust upon him. And he was like, "Oi, mate, you got to integrate these." And he turned around and go, "Dave, we've got to integrate these." And those fluid situations create opportunity. And I think I would say be nice and say thank you as well.
Okay, that's great. I like those last two. And then what, from your perspective, are the three key attributes that have enabled you the success that you've had?
I would definitely say I'm a team player.
Yeah.
I think that's critical. I think the growth mindset is another one, just to reemphasize that. Always be willing to learn, you know, from anyone. Doesn't matter how old they are or where they've come from, etc. That's key. Try and suss out great people. Work with great people. Try and find those people that are on a mission to do something. And again, this is for me personally. And, you know, hang on for dear life and sort of ride the wave with them, really. That's a tough one, though, because you can't always get it right. I often meet people that persuade me they can build a rocket out of blue cheese and fly to the moon by lunchtime. And I would say over the years, I've been, you know, suckered in on a couple of situations. But then you realize quickly and you've got to move on.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, some people can be very persuasive. So I guess it's having that awareness of when it's right and when it's not.
Exactly. And the numbers never lie. If you do well, you know, the P&L, you can sort of make a little bit pretty. Cash never lies. You know, once you start getting that cash flow in place and you start looking at the pipeline, it's very easy to rumble a bullshitter.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, look, it's been great chatting, David, and you've had obviously a very varied and interesting career. So really enjoyed talking, and hope you've enjoyed it too.
It's great. It's been my pleasure, Danny. Hope I haven't bored you silly. Thank you very much.
Not at all. Thanks a lot, David.
Cheers.
So that was David Bloom. I hope you enjoyed listening to David's story. Key themes that were discussed were around that growth mindset, surround yourself with good people and hanging on to their coattails. In terms of some advice that he gave, it was around initially making sure as an accountant that you learn the technical stuff. Because no matter what route you go down within finance, it's always important to understand and interpret the numbers. Try and get some good blue chip experience. Maybe even get to FC level and do a role there for 1 or 2 years in a big company. Pick an area that you enjoy working in and try and get yourself into fast growth situations where you have to learn and develop. And ultimately, he said, just make sure you're nice to people and always say thank you. In terms of the three key attributes that he mentioned in getting to where he has today, he spoke about being a team player, having that growth mindset, so always being willing to learn, no matter who it's from, and finding and working with great people. I hope you enjoyed listening to the episode, and as always, don't forget to subscribe, share and comment. You can find a list of confirmed future guests at successinfinance.co.uk, and you can watch recent video interviews on my YouTube channel. Thanks.